The lectionary, which is a three-year cycle of readings from the Bible, this week's gospel reading comes from the ninth chapter of the gospel called Mark. They're on their way to Jerusalem, Jesus and his followers. And Jesus is talking about the nature of discipleship. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? They went on from Caesarea Philippi and passed through Galilee. This is, as an aside, home turf for Jesus and his disciples. Jesus did not want anyone to know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him, and 3 days after being killed, he will rise again." But they did not understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask him. Then they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" But they were silent, for on the way they had been arguing with one another about who was the greatest. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." And then he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." The words of Jesus today are about power and powerlessness, about first and last, about being a disciple, about love and vulnerability. The text opens on a journey through Galilee south to Capernaum. And Jesus needed some time, Mark says, to be alone with the disciples. They were traveling kind of incognito in order to explain to the disciples what they were to expect when they hit Jerusalem. For Jesus knew, for him, that was the end of the line. The Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of the powerful. They will put him to death, and 3 days later, he will rise again. Goes a different translation than the one we read today. But the disciples did not understand, and they were afraid to ask. The last time Jesus had said that description of what was going to happen, Peter had rebuked him, and Jesus called Peter, "Satan, get thee behind me, Satan." After that, it's no wonder that the 12 were more than a little bit afraid to say something inappropriate to the master. They were afraid to say something inappropriate to the master, so naturally they decided to say inappropriate things among themselves, arguing among themselves about who was the greatest and what was the source of their power and greatness, that they might sit at the right hand of the Messiah in the place of honor when the kingdom comes. We don't know how it went, but I always imagine something like, "Yo, dude, Peter, like when Jesus sets up his kingdom and kicks the Romans out, I'm going to be like, so totally his right-hand man, dude. No, John, you're like a total loser. No, I'm JC's bestie, dude. No, me, says Matthew. No, me, says James." Well, they come to a quiet place in Capernaum, and they sit down. They're all a little perturbed, both by their own actions and words, but they also were bothered, I imagine, by the noise of children screeching outside. How annoying. And Jesus sat down with them, and Jesus asked them, "So what were you all arguing about on the way?" And they didn't look up. They did not look at him. They looked at their knees and at the dirt floor, dimly aware. Even Peter knew dimly that he must have done something wrong. And Jesus, perturbed at this behavior from the disciples, only days after the ugly incident with Peter, was at a loss of what to do. How do you explain authentic discipleship to a group as slow to learn and as quick to forget as this group of disciples? Mark's really tough on the disciples. He really depicts them as a bunch of boneheads. Luke and Matthew are a little kinder, but Mark's just like, God, these guys don't get it. Now, Mark is a very spare writer, so I have to fill in, we all have to fill in the blanks as we read him with our own imagination. And I've always imagined in this scene, suddenly a cry coming outside their dark, safe house, breaking their concentration, and Jesus going out to the open door into the dusty Palestinian street where you can hear the noise of playing children, and he goes out there and he brings one of them in. Perhaps a little Palestinian girl. Wide open dark eyes with a little star of light in them and a runny nose and a wild mop of pitch black hair. Dirty little hands and feet full of mung and gunk and stuff. That was my kids. I don't know about you. And Jesus hugs the little girl to reassure her and sets her down in the middle of the disciples. And he says, any of you who takes in a child like this and considers her as important as oneself is taking in me. And whoever takes in me is taking in the one who sent me. So that child, that one little inconsequential child, at least according to her culture, that child, Jesus is saying, is as important as God in the way you treat her. The way you treat her is a sign and symbol of how important God is to you. Now, in most sermons I have heard and read, and actually preached, I apologize, that I've heard preached about children and the realm of God, the pastor gives a pink and blue list of all the wonderful things about children that we're supposed to emulate. Obedience, innocence. Have you had children? Right? Okay. Meekness, mildness, gentleness. Yeah, well, it may not be very realistic about kids. These are pastors who either had really weird kids or none. But it's also off the point because the disciples were talking about power, its sources and its manifestations. The paradigm of the child is not obedience. It's powerlessness. That's why Jesus goes out and gets a child to show them. The disciples were talking about power. A child represents its very opposite, powerlessness and vulnerability. Jesus, in a sense, says, you want to know what discipleship looks like, campers? It's this. It's a child. It's powerlessness, vulnerability, openness, and the very distinct possibility of getting hurt. Not just 2,000 years ago, but now too. Children don't count. Children cannot vote, they don't pay taxes, they don't have super PACs, they can't work, senators will not go to bat for them, they are powerless. They are vulnerable to everyone and everything that is bigger than them, stronger than them, meaner than them, and more cunning than them. English teachers. In this wealthiest nation in the history of the world, a nation with more money than any other country in the history of money, 40% of our children live below the poverty line. Almost half. What does that say about our priorities around children? About family values? Vulnerable children are abused, ignored, neglected, forced to work in sweatshops, or, I don't mean in the States here, but your snappy Oriental rug was probably made by kids. Your snappy new Nike shoes, a certain percentage of them are made by kids. Immigrant and refugee children get jailed. They get sent back to war zones. They get called anchor babies and mini terrorists. Mini terrorists, did you hear that? By politicians and talking heads on news shows. Jesus says, whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. I believe he is saying that if you want to be disciples, you must become as vulnerable as this child that I have sat down in the middle of you. Discipleship means vulnerability. But not only that, when Jesus is talking about what is to become of him, betrayed, tortured, killed, he's also showing something of the nature of God's love, which is also vulnerability. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is one of the great Christian martyrs of the 20th century. I don't know how much y'all know of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a member of the Confessing Church in Nazi Germany. It was a small group of Christians who had the courage to say no to the twisted nationalism, the pornographic patriotism of Nazi Germany, and their elevation of Hitler to near divine status. Bonhoeffer was imprisoned in 1943 and executed in 1944, just days before the Allied forces liberated the camp he was in. While he was at the prison camp, he wrote some of the most powerful words on the nature of discipleship, what it meant to be a disciple of Jesus, what it cost to be a disciple of Jesus. He would fill up scraps of paper that were smuggled out of the camp by visitors. In one book, he writes of the powerlessness of God. He wrote, God allows God's own self to be edged out of the world and onto the cross. God is weak and powerless in the world, and that is exactly the way, the only way, in which he can be with us and help us. I had this on a fabulous slide on the wall. You could meditate on it. God is weak and powerless in the world. Now, that might sound nuts. Yes? The very definition of God is power. Yeah. Omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, holy, other, infinitely transcendent. Classical theology says that God cannot change, God cannot suffer, God is invulnerable. And yet Bonhoeffer reminds us that the God that we meet in Jesus Christ turns this idea of God on its head. In Jesus, God comes not in power, but in the most vulnerable form we have, a human infant, who would grow up to be not an emperor in Rome, but a peasant from the sticks on the edge of empire, who aligned himself with the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized, so much as to become one of them, so much so as to be arrested as a mere criminal, tortured and killed as a revolutionary. Killed! Think about this. What God gets killed? Marduk? Zeus? I don't know of any. Myself? What God gets killed? That's makes no sense. Now, yes, we'll all remember that there is resurrection and victory on the other side, but the road to resurrection and victory goes through a cross. The very sign of powerlessness, shame, and vulnerability. So what is going on here with this Jesus? How can God be powerless and vulnerable? and make a difference. A Canadian Anglican priest made the observation that, he wrote, "It seems to me that there are two kinds of vulnerability. There is what I might call given vulnerability." Now, given vulnerability means that's the way things are. A human baby is vulnerable. It's part of its definition of a human baby is vulnerability. It's a given. Homeless people and the mentally ill are vulnerable. Young women and girls in a patriarchal culture are very vulnerable. People with dementia are vulnerable. People who are old and infirm are vulnerable. The examples are endless. We could go on. There are so many people for whom particular realities cause them to carry a kind of vulnerability. It's a given. That kind of vulnerability does mean weakness, and it demands of others protection for them and caring for them or resources for them or changes to a society so that they are better. Given vulnerability is true weakness. But Father Purdy writes that there's another kind of vulnerability which is not a given but rather is chosen. Chosen vulnerability. I can choose to be vulnerable, to lay myself open to misunderstanding, to criticism, to ridicule, to rejection. But that's often a choice which leads to more open communication, deeper intimacy, personal growth. Now, how that vulnerability manifests itself is different for everybody in all sorts of different situations. It might be as sweet as the 16-year-old boy crossing the 5-mile-wide gymnasium to ask a girl to dance. It's vulnerable. While the guys are like, "Oh yeah, we remember that." It might be a young woman saying to a young man, "I love you," knowing he might run screaming away. But it might mean a white pastor standing with African American men and women on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, saying, "Black lives matter too." It might mean saying no to a man as Führer, to say only Jesus Christ is my leader. And all sorts of stuff in between. God will put opportunities for vulnerability before you. And discipleship is knowing when to say yes. Chosen vulnerability is not weakness. In fact, it requires much inner personal strength. It is risky. It can fail. It is exactly what it says it is, a personal choice to let down defenses and make oneself vulnerable. You have to know who you are. You have to know whose you are. You have to have a strong inner sense of self to make that choice. That's the kind of vulnerability. When Bonhoeffer talks about God being weak and powerless in the world, it is a chosen weakness, a chosen vulnerability. God is creator and all those powerful and amazing things. God sends galaxies spinning out like dandelion seeds across the cosmos. But in the realm of human freedom, God chose to empty God's own self. God poured God's self out, the fancy Greek word is kenosis, in order to be with us. God poured God's self out, let go of power, let go of everything in order to be not just with us, but become one of us in order to show us what true love is. True love is vulnerable. True love is sacrificial. True love is serving. I'm going to bring up another person from the Confessing Church. It's a guy named Martin Niemöller. He was not martyred, but he spent a lot of years talking about what it meant to be a disciple. He was a professor of my grandfather's. In 1931 and 1932 at Tübingen University in Germany. My grandfather left in 1933. Martin Niemöller was jailed in 1937 and was in jail throughout the entire war, and was released in 1944, freed alive by the Allies. And he said this: God will not ask me what I did from 1937 to 1944 when I was in prison. I was just there. He will ask me what I did from 1933 to 1937 when people were being burnt in ovens. I was too silent. And he later wrote a famous piece that unfortunately has been mangled and twisted and turned upside down by a lot of speakers and a lot of posters. But you'll recognize this. First they came for the communists, and I did not speak because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. This fall, we're talking about what it is for a church to be vibrant in the 21st century. I have a snappy slide, which I showed you last week, that said, don't just go to church, be the church. And that manifests most clearly in loving more and judging less. And that'll be our theme throughout the fall. It seems that a church to be vital in the 21st century has to do two things. It has to make a conscious choice to welcome and help and struggle for and with the most vulnerable in our culture and in the world. And second, the church needs to embrace its own vulnerability, its chosen vulnerability, by choosing to love radically. I had another beautiful slide to show you today of a Turkish couple. You may have seen this in the news. Turkish couple's wedding. They live near the Turkish-Syrian border. And as they came up close to the day of their wedding, they were going to be spending a whole boatload of money on a reception for all their friends, like you do. My daughter is working as a caterer now. You would not believe what people are spending on wedding receptions. Oh, my gosh. Now, this was in Turkey. Probably wasn't quite as elaborate as the one at, say, Lang Farm or in Shelburne. But they looked at what the reality of what was happening, and they took all that money that they were going to put into a reception to feed their friends. They borrowed a food truck and fed 4,000 Syrian refugees instead. And there's this lovely picture of them in a food truck, just like you see in Burlington. He's in his tuxedo, and she's got this amazing white gown and a tiara, for crying out loud, serving up outreached hands, people who are hungry, people who needed something desperately, and certainly more than their good friends did. That's big stuff. And people saw that online. It went viral, and it made a difference. It won hearts over all over the world. I was wondering about how do we talk about welcome here at Essex Center United Methodist Church. Once someone is here and in this building and they have endured a 10-minute passing the peace with a whole bunch of strangers coming up and saying, "Hi, give me a hug," they know they are welcome. But how do they know by driving by and looking at this building? Exactly. Now, I know a lot of churches that have a sign out front that says, "Blah, blah, blah church, everybody welcome." But what does that mean? Do you know anyone who is everyone? Exactly. Think about it. It's kind of silly. I don't know anybody who is everyone. So how do we let folk more specifically know they are welcome here? Now, we don't have a sign out front except the name of the church and the time and the goober who preaches here. But let's ask some questions. I'm in a wheelchair. What is a concrete thing in this church that shows I'm welcome here? We have an elevator. We have an elevator. That says, we care enough about you to change our architecture and spend some money to buy this thing. We welcome you here. I'm a single mom. What's the specific thing we have that shows I'm welcome here? Sorry? We have a nursery downstairs. I have some fabulous slides for this, too. But we know we have set up a nursery with folk who will love my kid so I can be in worship for an hour. I'm welcome. It's a concrete act that says, we appreciate your being here. We welcome you here. Okay, I'm gay, I'm bisexual, I'm transgendered. What is a symbol that says we welcome you and celebrate how God is working in you? We smile? What's that?
We've got a pastor who welcomes people like that, among other things.
Well, okay, so you've got a pastor, but nobody cares about what the pastor thinks. Yes, we do. True fact. And we have beautiful and welcomed and beloved gay, lesbian, bisexual folk here. We also have a family with a transgendered child who is a little too scared to come to church because she doesn't know how she'll be treated. Love more. Judge less. That's a sign I want to put out on the front of the building. You can get a cheap outdoor vinyl sign from Staples for not too much money. And with the trustees' permission, we can find some nice way to chunk that on. But here's the thing. If I'm gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, I still don't know if it's safe. Love more, judge less. I don't know what that means. Some of us were on a long car ride coming up from New Hampshire and discussing how do we make it more visible. That's the thing I'm asking y'all to pray about and discuss. I'm going to ask you to be vulnerable. You ready? I'm going to ask you to do something that might scare you, and I want you to reflect about what can God do with this. But here's something I'm asking y'all to pray about and discuss. One sign, one symbol that says we are safe, we love you, we will grow with you, and we will help you connect to the God of vulnerable love is what Catherine just said, a rainbow flag, or some kind of rainbow symbol. It does not say that everybody in this place agrees about gender and sexuality, about the theology or the sociology or the psychology of gender and sexuality, but it does say that we will all love you and care for you and grow with you. However God calls us to, and with whomever God sends to us, regardless of their gender, their sexuality. I had a really fabulous slide with that too, with a little rainbow spray here. This is why I'm a little cranky about this. But you can imagine in your mind's eye, love more, judge less, with a symbol that tells people going by, here's the church that's willing to put that out in public. So I'm going to ask you, what scares you about that? What's scary about that? Oh, come on.
We're going to have to defend our beliefs.
What happens when someone says, you do that? What's wrong with you? I thought you were Christians.
We are.
I thought you believed in the Bible. We do. We are. But you will get that. That's what scares me. Here's another scary thing is, and here's a big thing. If you are uneasy about this, I want you to know that everyone here is safe to talk about with that, to say, I'm uneasy about this, and here's why. And I, over the next 2 weeks, I want us to be able to talk about it and to discuss it and to pray about it and to be thinking and cogitating and all those things, because in 2 weeks, what I want us to do is, after church, during coffee hour, I want us to say, what are we going to do? We'll have a church meeting, and what is it? Are we going to make be a witness? Are we going to be disciples that can do this? If not, that's cool. But this is an area from the I got interviewed here. It was, how do we make ourselves make a difference in the community? And how do we make a visible welcome to everybody? So we'll play with that in 2 weeks. So this gospel story calls us to two things. On the one hand, we're called to be like the child. Powerless sometimes in the face of the world's demands, not sure if we can do it on our own, and knowing that we can't, but trusting that God loves us no matter who we are. On the other hand, we're called to be like the disciples, called to accept a life of faith that is sometimes exhilarating and sometimes painful, but we meet each joy and challenge as we receive Christ's teachings into all aspects of our living and are loving. We're called to offer love to those who have given vulnerability. The biblical norm for that, the widow, the orphan, the alien, and our own. We have lists. There are the people in wheelchairs, people who are sick, people who are mentally ill, people who are anything. We are called to meet them with love. And we're called to choose vulnerability. Because entering into love with those who are vulnerable can cause misunderstanding, and you might catch some grief for it. And I figure, if you don't catch a little grief from the world, you're not doing this discipleship thing right. Back to that quiet room in Capernaum, surrounded by his silent and watching disciples, Jesus gives the little girl one last squeeze. She squirms and giggles, and then that powerless one who pulled rank with a runny nose skips out from the dark room into the bright sun to play again in the dusty Palestinian street. Amen.